next 90 minutes standing here talking about Mel Gibson, so I hope you're all okay with that. Good evening, welcome to Sugar Club. My name is Adrian Carty. I am the producer of Nothing Is Real, and in what will become apparent in about 90 seconds in clear 4K vision, the youngest and best looking of the trio. Thank you. So there is nothing left for me to say, really. So without further ado, please welcome on stage Jason Carty and Stephen Cockcroft for Nothing Is Real Live.
Ladies and gentlemen, please take a few seconds to switch off your mobile phones while we welcome you to Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles, tonight, live at the Sugar Club. Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? We know that his name is Jason Carty, and his name is Stephen Cockcroft. And together, they're Jason Carty and Stephen Cockcroft. And now, live, Nothing Is Real.
Welcome to Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we know? Wow. Oh, amazing.
You've arrived.
My name's Jason Carty.
My name's Stephen Cockcroft.
And we're live in person from Dublin. How about that? That's very exciting. That's very exciting. Hello, Dublin. There's a lot of amazing things that have happened on the streets around the Sugar Club. We are around the corner from Hatch Street, where yes. Ringo got his driver's license.
You're saying it's a 10-year driving license?
Yeah.
So yesterday he was probably around there renewing his driving
By
license?
By pure accident, this is the 60th anniversary week of the Beatles' only show in Dublin. Tuesday night was the 60th anniversary. And the legend, the truth is, the following day, Ringo, who was banned from driving in the UK, sent a lackey down to Hatch Street to get a driver's license, an Irish driver's license. It is also next door to the newsagents where about 10 or 15 years ago, Paul McCartney tried to buy a chocolate bar with sterling. And he was told by the shopkeeper that, no, we use euros here. And he went back to his driver and somebody ran out from the shop with a bar of chocolate for Paul McCartney. So that's the level of detail we'll be getting into tonight about the Beatles. I'd like to thank the man who told me that story last Sunday, if he's here. Hello. Because it's very interesting. So, chances are you're here because you listen to Nothing Is Real. And if you don't listen to Nothing Is Real, you're probably married to someone who listens to Nothing Is Real. So we do apologise in advance. We are a Beatles podcast, I would say.
We are indeed.
We've got over 150 episodes about the Beatles. And, you know, what we're going to try and do tonight is a live version of the podcast with a bit of kind of live interaction as well.
Yeah.
That's kind of it. But incredibly, we've been doing this since 2019, and that's us back then. So, what are we doing? What are we talking about?
What are we going to look at? We're going to look at two eras of the Beatles as live performers. So their very first tour in 1960, and their very last gig before paying audience, before anybody starts talking about the rooftop. Before a paying audience in 1966.
Yeah, so we're going to, since this is a live show, we thought we would do a live show about live shows.
Way we roll.
Very meta. We thought we'd do all the live shows, but there's just too many live shows.
Too many.
So we want to tell a story. We want to tell a story about a beginning and an end. So a story about the Beatles' first tour, which took them to Scotland. Oh, great, the tech has turned off. Which took them to Scotland, where they kind of became, you know, they weren't professional, but by the end of it, it had made a huge difference in their lives.
Yes. I think what we're going to try and explain, convince you, is that this is when they became the Beatles.
Yeah.
In 1960.
And then we're going to bookend that in the second half by telling you the story of their last gig. And, you know, the overlap is how they were essentially the same bunch of guys. There's only 6 years between their very first, you know, professional paid live tour and the time when they decided to knock it on the head. So that is the story we're going to tell you tonight about how they became who they were and how they stayed true to who they were and how that was how they ended their live career. Fair enough?
Seems straightforward.
So, you know, people have probably seen this photo before, 1957, John Lennon on stage, Paul McCartney sees him perform for the first time. This is the start of the start, and people probably all know this image, which is, you know, the Beatles live on the rooftop. But when we talk about the Beatles' first proper tour, what are we talking about?
We're talking Scotland.
We are talking that the Beatles go to Scotland. So that's the first thing we're going to tell you about tonight. Shall we sit
down? Can we sit down now?
Shall we sit down now?
Yeah, that's fine.
I know it's a bit Skinner and Badil, isn't it?
Which one are you?
It's a reference for the kids.
Okay. You see, everyone will notice that he has a clipboard.
I have a clipboard because...
I have a staple.
You know, I feel like a builder. That's got to go, you know, that's my clipboard joke. When we talk about the Beatles' first proper tour, we're going back to 1960. This is very early in their story. So this is, you know, pre-Ringo. It's pre-Pete Best. It's pre-Beatles in leather playing in Hamburg. It's really gone back to the very early days when we start with John, Paul and George, who sometimes would call themselves the Japage Three, John, Paul, George, which is the worst name ever. So what we want to do is tell you the story and the feedback, because obviously when the Beatles first went on tour, people weren't buying tickets to go see the Beatles. They didn't want to see the Beatles. They were going to see this guy. And this guy is John Askew. And who is this man? I ask you.
Tick.
All right.
There will be more.
Oh, yeah.
There will be more.
Right, you know.
This is Johnny Gentle.
Johnny Gentle, yes. And who is Johnny Gentle?
Yeah, Johnny Gentle was a solo singer. And he was part of, shall we say, the stable, mm-hmm. the Larry Parnes stable. So Larry Parnes was an impresario.
Yes.
Is that the polite way of describing Larry Parnes?
He was an impresario.
He was really a sort of manager, the late 50s, early 60s. His modus operandi, mm-hmm. I'm treading carefully here, was to find good-looking young men and groom them, is that the word? Groom them...
For stardom.
For
stardom. yeah.
So what he would do is he would find actors, singers, he would put them together on package tours, he would market them as... he really had solo singers sewn up in
and
the UK.
He was a great wheeler dealer, Parnes, because he started kind of in the West End. He was doing plays. He was always on for gimmicks to try and get people in the door, that kind of thing.
Yeah, he's famously promoted a play called The House of Shame, which is a good title to begin with.
Yep.
But the way he promoted this was he hired two actresses to stand outside the door dressed as prostitutes. We tried that this evening, but they didn't show, so...
So he wasn't above doing anything kind of slightly nefarious. He broke through big into the music business with this guy, Tommy Steele, who people might know. And Tommy Steele is a guy who began his career writing with Lionel Bart. Lionel
yep.
Bart, was the guy who wrote like "Livin' Doll" for Cliff Richard, a very talented songwriter. And Tommy Steele became like a protege of Larry Parnes, and this was kind of his big. His big kind of pop music breakthrough, because Larry Parnes would kind of take people and just recast them and rename them.
It was almost like actors, because the show business path at this stage was you had a couple of singles and then you moved into variety, you moved into theatre, which is basically the path that Tommy Steele took. And amusingly, he was seen as the anti-Cliff Richard. You know, he was the raucous alternative in the UK to Cliff Richard.
Yeah. And so Larry Parnes basically had, great form. He had made a run of pop stars by the time we get to 1960.
Yeah.
So...
you got a list?
I love a list. I've got a good list here. So do you want to do the real names?
Okay.
So
this is... He would rename these people. So you've probably not heard of Reginald Leonard Smith.
Who's Marty Wilde.
Ron Wycherly. You probably know Ron Wycherly.
Billy Fury.
Roy Taylor.
Vince Eager.
Richard Kneller.
This is my favourite one. Dickie Pride.
Chris Morris.
Who was Lance Fortune.
Ray Howard.
Who was Duffy Power.
Malcolm Holland.
Who was Nelson Keane.
This is an interesting one. Clive Powell.
Well, this is someone who's still on the scene. Georgie Fame.
So Georgie Fame said Parnes gave him an ultimatum. And said, if you don't use the name, I won't put you in the show. And Parnes was so well known for this, the way that he operated, that he was actually parodied by Peter Sellers. So there was an album called Songs for Swinging Sellers in 1959, if anybody has got that album. And it was produced by George Martin. And Sellers created a character called Major Rafe Ralph, who was a former horse dealer who had moved into promoting pop stars such as Matt Lust, Clint Thigh, and Lenny Bronze, who all shared a luxury Mayfair flat with Major Rafe Rafe. So it was pretty near the knuckle.
Pretty near the knuckle.
Pretty true as well, I think.
And what I like about all this is that, you know, he's trying to create these stage names: Wild, Eager, Pride, Fortune. So it only makes sense that eventually it gets to Johnny Gentle. A nice sort of, not really the most powerful or exciting number of names. We don't really think of Johnny Gentle an awful lot.
But it could have been worse, because, you know, Joe Brown? Joe Brown and the Brothers? He actually wanted him to change his name to Elmer Twitch.
That's not good.
I think what was going on? Anyway.
So getting back to Johnny Gentle, he is one of the Larry Parnes stable, and he's got songs that go like this. That wasn't a hit. Neither was Milk from the Coconut.
No.
That was not a hit for Johnny Gentle either. In 1959, he put out those two singles. So by the time we get to 1960, and we've Larry Parnes putting things together. He's like Mr. Showbiz. And so Larry Parnes has this show planned for Liverpool for the 3rd of May, 1960.
Yes, because Parnes, in addition to being a manager, he's also a promoter. And he would promote these package tours. And the show was the 3rd of May 1960, and it was to be headlined by Gene Vincent and Eddie Cochran. Hmm. And it was at Liverpool Stadium, which is sort of fairly big by the standards of the day. I mean, normally, when we look at what the venues the Beatles were playing in the early 60s, there are maybe 1,500, 2,000, 2,500. Liverpool Stadium is a big 3,700 seat boxing arena.
It's a boxing stadium. Yeah. It's probably a bit like Dublin's National Stadium, but bigger. Yeah, it's a boxing arena. And so the plan is that Gene Vincent and Eddie Cochran were due to be co-headliners. And Gene Vincent and Eddie Cochran loom large in the Beatles legend. That first day when Paul met John, John is singing Gene Vincent's Bebopalula. Paul is playing Eddie Cochran's 30 Flight Rock. You know, these guys are a big deal. But there is a strange series of events and butterfly effects that happen in the fortnight before.
Yeah. So Gene Vincent and Eddie Cochran were already in the UK and already on a tour, and they finished that tour on the 16th of April. And they get a taxi from the venue back to their hotel. And there's a car accident. The driver of the car is speeding, loses control. Cochran is killed in that incident. But there are two interesting things.
Yeah, there are two kind of butterfly effects that kind of happen from this. So, you know, there's an awful lot of happenstances, many of you'll know, in the Beatles story. But one is, one of the people who tried to get a lift in the car that night was Tony Sheridan. And if people know Tony Sheridan, he would eventually, in Hamburg, be the first person to bring the Beatles into a recording studio, record with the Beatles, record My Bonnie Lies Over the Ocean, a single which lands back in Liverpool, which brings the Beatles to the attention of Brian Epstein. So, you know, if Tony Sheridan had gotten in the car that night, we don't know whether that branch of the story would have ever happened. But the other kind of odd coincidence is the driver of the taxi.
Yeah, you heard it here first. The driver of the taxi in which Eddie Cochran died was George Martin.
Mm. Not that one.
No, a different George Martin.
Sorry, we should have been clear. Not that George Martin, another George Martin.
I think somebody fainted over there.
Yeah. I'm shocked. But the other butterfly effect is, obviously, this bill means that, you know, there is no return of Eddie Cochran. He wasn't that good. So you have... too soon?
Too soon.
Okay, sorry. So this gig still has to go ahead. So Larry Parnes decides to dip into the pool of Liverpool talent.
Yes, so he's co-promoting this gig with Alan Williams, who sort of owns clubs in Liverpool. He's a small-time operator, but he's a promoter. And he had seen various rock acts in Liverpool and thought, this would be great. So he gets in touch, with Parnes and says, well, presumably we're not going to go ahead. But Parnham says, no, you know, show must go on. Get me some local bands. So we end up with Liverpool bands getting this sort of exposure on a stage with Gene Vincent. So there's Cass and the Casanovas, Jerry and the Pacemakers, and Rory Storm and the Hurricanes, which means that Mr. Ringo Starr is on stage.
Yeah, so Ringo is drumming for Rory Storm and the Hurricanes that night. He is, you know, he is in plain view. So Larry Parnes gets to think, oh, Liverpool has some bands, and, you know, they're up to the job, and they're able to do all of that. So he's kind of impressed with what he sees in Liverpool.
Yeah. So it is the lot of the solo singer in the late 50s and early 60s to just be sent out on tour with a pickup band. So the promoter or the manager will provide a band. So Parnes, as you say, is very impressed. You know, Rory Storm and the Hurricanes are a tight professional outfit. They're playing Butlins, so they're earning money. These bands are professional bands in Liverpool. So he organizes auditions a week. So the big show is on the 3rd. He organizes auditions on the 10th of May and comes back up with Billy Fury, who is looking for a band to go out on tour with.
So I know you didn't come to the Larry Parnes podcast. So let's ask the question, where are the Beatles? When we say the Beatles, what are the Beatles at this point?
Yeah, so the Beatles, excuse me, the Beatles do manage to grab a spot on this audition. But when we say the Beatles, you know, it was around this time, sort of mid-April, that they're starting to think about changing their name. So they have been called the Quarrymen.
I've changed that.
But that's excellent. That's very good.
I just realised Ado's computer doesn't have the Beatles font, so it doesn't look quite as good. It's a pity, really.
It's terrible. It's very bad.
Anyway.
Take a note. Anyway, so they've been called the Quarrymen up to this point, and they're sort of toying with... They're not a professional band. They're just mates pretending to be in a band. You know, they're not playing professionally. They're not playing for money. The person who comes up with the name supposedly is Stuart Sutcliffe. They're just sitting in a bar. There's Stuart, John, and Cynthia. They come up with the name. They're walking away from the bar. They meet Paul McCartney, and they say, "Oh, by the way, we've decided we're now going to be called the Beatles."
The Beatles. We all know this name, don't we? The Beatles. That's what Stuart thought the band should
Stuart,
be spelt. That was
Stuart
his idea.
Never lost the notion that it had to be Beatles with two A's.
Yeah, Beatles. Well, two A's. I mean, Beatles. Yeah, it's very. It's not what we know and love, which is
Beatles.
But Beatles with an A was how Stuart Sutcliffe spent it. So it's right at the end of April, just before these auditions, where the name Beatles hovers into view. So this is when they start to be called the Beatles, and they land a spot on this audition. And if I remember rightly, you've got John, Paul, you've got George and Stuart.
Yeah.
Nary a percussionist among them.
No.
So what do they do?
They Stuart Sutcliffe is very friendly with Alan Williams. And it's through that friendship. Can you do something for us? Can you get us on the on these auditions? And Alan Williams says, yep, absolutely. But you'll need a drummer. So they don't know what to do about this. Cass from Cass and the Casanovas recommends somebody called Tommy Moore. So he is asked to come to the audition. And this is something I only realized when we were researching, because you do some research.
you were researching.
The audition is on the 10th of May. Tommy Moore is their drummer. Not only have they never played together before, they have never seen him. They haven't met him. So they're going to meet for the first time seconds before they play the audition for Larry Parnes and Billy Fury.
So they do this audition. We have pictures from the day themselves. There's Billy Fury and Larry Parnes with their audition faces on. So we should go through the bands who were playing. There was the Big Three.
The Big Three.
We don't know how tall they were. We have Derry and the Seniors.
Featuring Howie Casey on...
Featuring Howie Casey here, friend of the show. He went on to be in the horn section for the Wings tour in 1976. Very nice bloke. We also have, who are these guys? Jerry and the Pacemakers.
Jerry and the Pacemakers. Explain your Pacemakers.
Oh, yeah. I was very interested because this is 1960, and I was like, why, you know, when did commercial-grade medical pacemakers come onto the market? Because I think that's a legitimate question, and the answer is around about 1958. So they would have been the hot new band. It's like having a band nowadays called Jerry and the ChatGPTs, do you know what I mean? It's kind of on a similar type of level. So like a pacemaker was like a sci-fi device in 1960.
Whatever you say.
I swear to it.
It's worth it. Could have been motorways.
Here we have Cliff Roberts and the Rockers.
No
we
idea.
We know nothing about Cliff Roberts and the Rockers. Nothing. History does not recall. But
they're still going. I find them on YouTube. If you look on YouTube, they're still going.
Good Lord. Still auditioning.
Still auditioning.
Yeah. Someone should tell them. It seems unfair. And then you have the Beatles.
The Beatles.
And how did they do?
They did not do well.
No.
So they turn up. They say, we are the Beatles. Cass from Cass and the Casanova says, this is the worst name ever. You have to be somebody and the somethings. So on the spot, he christens them Long John and the Silver Beatles. Or according to Paul, Long John Silver and the Pieces of Eight. But if you ask George, he would say Long John and the Pieces of Silver. John Lennon says Long John and the Silver Man. So take your pick. But anyway, they audition with some variation of that name that no one could quite remember. But this is where the notion of the Silver Beatles comes into play. Alan Williams, will stick in his head, and long after they become the Beatles, he still refers to them as the Silver Beatles.
And the other thing that happened that day was when Stuart Sutcliffe would play, he would play with his back to the audience or to whoever was playing. That was just his style. He would do a moody, which there's a legend that that's what lost them the audition, but they were probably just generally not very good.
They weren't a band. And what happened is, I said they were going to meet Tommy Moore for the first time that day. He doesn't turn up. Mm. So they have to keep going and saying, look, can you put somebody else on first before us? You know, put somebody else on. Can we go last? And eventually they run out of time. And they have to start the audition with a different drummer, which is Johnny Hutch from the Big Three. And he hates them. I mean, he absolutely hates them. To the extent that when he's offered at one point, to replace Pete Best, he says no because he just thinks they're posers, they're art school guys. But he drums for a couple of songs, then Tommy Moore turns up. And you can see in the photographs of the day, the drummer will change. And you see they made an attempt to sort of establish a uniform. And George Harrison said, beforehand, we went out and bought some string shoes with little white bits on the top. We were very poor and never had matching clothes. But we tried to put together a uniform, black shirts and these shoes. And I thought, well, string shoes? Lace-ups. He means lace-ups.
Just laces.
Laces.
They don't get the Billy Fury gig.
They don't get any.
They don't get any gigs at all. But then fate comes knocking. Once again, the Beatles never planned anything. Happenstance would always take over. And so Cass and the Casanovas get the Billy Fury gig.
Yeah.
But lo and behold, there's this Johnny Gentle gig that also comes in the offing. And the Beatles are first on the list for the Johnny Gentle.
No.
They're not even wanted for the Johnny Gentle tour.
No.
How do they end up working with Johnny Gentle?
Well, you may have noticed that one band that wasn't doing the audition was Rory Storm and the Hurricanes. And that was because they were playing Butlins, so couldn't have gone, or they had a date lined up. So Alan Parnes gets in touch with Alan, or Larry Parnes gets in touch with Alan Williams, says, I need a band for the Johnny Gentle tour. So he goes to Rory Storm and the Hurricanes. They're in Butlins. He then goes to Cass and the Casanovas, but they're already booked to play two Liverpool shows. Derry and the Seniors, Jerry and the Pacemakers, he approaches them. They are part-time musicians. They all have day jobs, and they're not prepared to sort of take 10 days off to go to Scotland. So he's tried four professional bands.
That leaves them with choice number five, the Beatles, with Tommy Moore as their drummer.
Yeah.
And this all happens very quickly. The the Gene Vincent show is the 3rd of May. The auditions are the 10th of May. And the Johnny Gentle tour is due to start on the 20th of May in Scotland. So we should pause and just say, well, where are our four Beatle friends once they get this Johnny Gentle gig? What stages are they at in their life?
Right. Well, as I say, at this stage, they don't have jobs. So they're not constrained in that way. John is living, no longer living in Menlo Avenue. He's at Gambier Terrace. So he doesn't even tell Aunt Mimi that he is that he's
so
got
John's this gig. Matriarchal Aunt Mimi, who had controlled his life, just doesn't even know that he's disappearing off to Scotland.
But he is at college and he does have coursework. But that doesn't matter because his girlfriend Cynthia is at art college and she can do the coursework. Easy.
And there's another young student called Paul McCartney who's about to sit his A-levels.
Paul McCartney is 2 weeks away.
That's him there.
From sitting his A-levels. Did he get the right one?
Yeah.
So his A-levels include an art A-level, which includes a written exam that actually is taking place while the tour will be on. So he will fail his art A-level. That's just a given.
Yep.
If he goes, he will not get his art A-level. So he's living at home with his father and with his brother Mike. He has to persuade his dad to let him go. So bear in mind, this is Paul, PR man, par excellence. So he persuades his dad, first of all, that the school have given him a week off to revise.
You know, like they do. Yep.
And he persuades his father that a week in Scotland, that the fresh air in Scotland would be restorative and would help him revive.
The Paul McCartney reality distortion field strikes again.
Yeah.
Where he bends people to his will.
Yep.
It's fantastic. Our good friend George Harrison was 6 months into an electrician's apprenticeship, which is a pretty solid job for a young teenager in Liverpool. Not something you'd want to throw away lightly.
No, if you've got a trade, you've got it made. That was the mantra. So he has to decide, is he going to stick with this apprenticeship or is he going to go off with his rock and roll band? There is no hesitation.
Yep. George just wants to play.
He's gone. He is not cut out to be an electrician.
And his older brother says, you know, there are other jobs. If this is what you want to do, off you go. The person with the most to lose is Stuart Sutcliffe, because he is a proper artist. He's not really a musician in the same way. You know, he's coming up to the final exams of his four-year art course. His mum is distraught, Millie Sutcliffe, that he's going to head off. And, you know, Stuart kind of said, well, I could probably, I'm so good, I could miss a week of college and still get my exams. That's his general take.
Pretty much. Thoughts. Pretty much. And there is a sense that Stuart is, it's almost like performance art. You know, he's, I mean, look at the picture. You know, he's playing the part of a rock and roll star. And of course, we can't forget about Tommy.
Tommy Moore, who's much older than the other Beatles. He's 29. He's
ancient.
He's so old for that kind of time. He's hitting on 30 and he thinks, well, you know, I'm going to get 15 quid and that's more than I get from a week of my work in the factory. So I'll take a week of leave and just go off to Scotland.
Yeah.
That's kind of his general take. And, you know, Johnny Gentle, you know, has said, oh, he sent the Beatles their repertoire to learn, but they just weren't that type of band.
No, Johnny Gentle will say we sent them the repertoire 2 weeks before the start of the tour. Well, we know that that's not right because, again, the timeline is so compressed. So it's the 18th is when Alan Williams gets in touch. He tries everybody else. The 19th, he settles on the Beatles. They possibly have one night of a rehearsal, and then the next day they're on a train to Scotland. So this notion that they had 2 weeks to rehearse is just... we find there's a lot of revisionism in this story.
So let's have a look at Scotland. There's Scotland. And they do seven shows between the 20th and the 28th of May. Seven shows in 9 days. And let's follow them. They start in Alloa, and here's the best slide of the night.
He's going to want applause.
Hey, there we go. They go off to Inverness. Then they go over to Fraserburgh. Then they go back to the town of Keith. Then Forres. Then a town called Nairn. And then they end in Peterhead. That's the tour that they do. Thanks. Thank you very much. Good night. No. So the first show is on May the 20th, and it's in Alloa. So it's a little bit. So they've driven up from Liverpool, which is obviously down behind the couch. And yeah, there's a lot hanging on this kind of first gig. It's the biggest gig of the tour.
It is the biggest gig. It's a Friday night in Alloa. You know, fun times.
Oh.
Fun times.
It happens in Alloa, am I right?
Stays in Alloa, absolutely.
Yeah.
So Johnny Gentle will also, so having said they had 2 weeks to learn the material, he will then say, we met at the venue half an hour before our first public performance, and all things considered, we sounded pretty good from the off. They didn't. They really didn't. Every night the sound got better, and by the end of the tour, I knew these boys were as good as any I had ever worked with.
Yeah, that's very
a lot of rewriting of history. Yeah.
You know, George has said, you know, we were like orphans. Our shoes were full of holes. Our trousers were a mess. While Johnny Gentle had a posh suit, I remember trying to play "Won't You Wear My Ring Around Your Neck." He was doing Elvis's Teddy Bear, and we were crummy. The band was horrible, an embarrassment. We didn't have amplifiers or anything.
He didn't even have a shirt, George, to match.
No, he didn't.
The black shirts. For some reason, he did not have his black shirt, so Johnny Gentle had to lend him a shirt.
And it's also the only proper photographic evidence we have of the tour is from this first night, which is this picture. And there's Johnny Gentle, and there's George in the background, and there's the people of Alloa. It's hard to know what to make of that, really.
Yeah. And the support act. I mean, it would have been a good night's entertainment. The support act was Alex Harvey.
Yes.
And his Big Beat Band. So if you know Alex, the sensational Alex Harvey Band, he would then go to Hamburg and sort of follow in the Beatles' footsteps.
Alex Harvey, was a fantastic performer. Very kind of magnetic, amazingly. But, so Paul said in Anthology, suddenly we were in Scotland with one of Larry's untemptuous acts and a tour when I should have been doing my exams. A lot of my parents' hope were going up the spout because I was off with these naughty boys who weren't doing GCEs at all. Very different from George's everything's crummy approach.
Yeah.
Paul's like famous five, Enid Blyton, Larks.
It's a Larks lark.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all great crack. So that's how they start the tour. Night number two is when they go further north to Inverness. And, you know, they are really out
far away on the road
for the first time. This is the second gig on the 21st of May, 1960, at Inverness Northern Meeting Hall.
Yeah, so this is the Saturday night, and they should have been playing in Latham Hall in Liverpool that night. There was a promoter there, Brian Kelly, had booked them to play. Alan Williams had set the gig up, but they forgot to tell Brian Kelly that they were in Scotland. So all these people turned up at Latham Hall. And this sort of blots their copybook for a long time with Brian Kelly when they get back to Liverpool.
And Inverness was kind of familiar to them because George and John had been to Inverness as kids. You know, John had a connection with Edinburgh as well. On this night in particular, the admission was 3 shillings before 8 p.m. and 5 shillings afterwards. But there's another kind of sliding doors moment with the act that's playing elsewhere in the building.
There is, because if you were so minded, instead of being upstairs watching Johnny Gentle, you could have been downstairs watching Lindsay Ross and his famous broadcasting band, who were celebrating the release of their first single on Parlophone, produced by
George Martin. Not the taxi
not
driver.
The taxi
not
driver.
The taxi The other George Martin.
Yeah.
Okay. It's probably worth mentioning that while they're on the road having larks, they, you know, being famous for the first time, they decide to try their hand at pseudonyms.
Yes. We should have done that.
What?
We should have done that.
We should have done that, yeah. Jason Grayson.
Jason Grayson.
Yeah,
that was great. The most disappointing moment of my entire life, is finding out he wasn't actually called Jason Grayson.
But they do all have pseudonyms, and they all have a story behind them. So Paul calls himself Paul Ramon, which, if anybody knows your Beatle history, the fantastic thing about that is he later goes on to record the song Ramon on the Ram album. But also, this is the pseudonym. This brief pseudonym is what gives us the name The Ramones. That's the Ramones got their name from Paul's Scottish tour pseudonym. Butterfly effects everywhere. What other pseudonyms do we have?
We have George becomes Carl Harrison for Carl Perkins. John Lennon maybe becomes Long John. John will say he never changed his name. Paul, very adamant he did.
Yeah.
And then Stuart Sutcliffe adopts the nom de base, Stuart de Stael, or de Stael.
It's a painter name. It's a painter reference.
I know that.
I don't know that. So they kind of think, okay, we're on the road 2 or 3 days in. Let's all take on and assume an identity. Let's act like we're famous, you know. When they were on tour, the Beatles would play a few songs to kind of warm up the crowd.
They get to play 3 songs beforehand. And they were usually pretty democratic at this stage. So John, Paul, George, they would rotate. But on this tour, what we know is that John sang 3 songs. So they had a little opening set. No one can remember what those songs actually were. Then Johnny Gentle would come on. And he was not, it was called the Beat Ballad Tour. So he is singing things like Teddy Bear, Wear My Ring Around Your Neck, Raining in My Heart by Buddy Holly, Poor Little Fool, Ricky Nelson, Come On Everybody by Eddie Cochran, and I don't know why, but I do, by Clarence Frogman Henry. And we can talk about Clarence Frogman Henry for an hour.
Nope, we can't. But Clarence Frogman Henry, he was kind of called the Frogman because he had a kind of a deep voice, the way frogs sing.
Yes. Disappointingly, not an actual frogman.
No, he's not.
He had a song in which the first verse he sang very high, and then the second verse in the middle, and then he was did his frog chorus at the end.
Hey! But he does go on in 1964 to support the Beatles when they're touring the US. So he plays 18 shows on their 1964 tour.
Yeah, and he's still going. Yeah. So he doesn't much leave New Orleans. We should have a show in
New Orleans. We should go to New Orleans. Either that or the Vegas sphere.
Yeah, that would be good.
The next day is actually a day off, Sunday the 22nd. We don't really know what they did.
No, we know they didn't do their laundry.
No laundry.
Because their stage clothes were their everyday clothes. They didn't think to pack a change of clothes. So they're just wearing the same things.
Not very hygienic.
No.
So that brings us to the third show, May the 23rd, in Fraserburgh, which I'm totally paranoid about pronouncing.
Fraserburgh.
And if this is remembered for anything, it's remembered for the van.
The van. Nice motor.
Nice motor. There we go. Tick that off your cards. There is a car crash. The van that they are in has a crash when they're trying to get to this gig. So what happens?
Their regular driver, Jerry Scott, has decided he wants a day off. So he's sleeping in the back of the van. There are no seats. This is, you know, people are perched on mud guards and on equipment in the back of the van. Johnny Gentle is driving. John Lennon is asleep beside him. And he drives into the back of a Ford Popular.
Oh, dear.
And no one is seriously injured, thankfully, except Tommy Moore.
Yeah.
And a guitar... Okay, I have to get through this without laughing. A guitar case hits him in the face and knocks out his front teeth. Oh, I see.
Yeah.
And the Belfast audience laughed. That's Belfast
that's
for you.
Have those teeth come up in Christie's or anything like that? No.
Not yet. We're probably still at the roadside.
Yeah, that's worth a bit of money.
There is this crash. He is sufficiently badly injured to require an ambulance. So those are the days you could get an ambulance.
They call
an ambulance. But the sound of the car crash has alerted the locals who sort of come around. It was probably entertainment in Fraserburgh, to be honest. And amongst the crowd that come, there are two teenage girls who think, oh, it's a band. And they run back and they come back with their autograph books. So these are the first two sets of autographs by the Beatles.
Yep. And it's nice that they've written Beatles on them.
You can see at some point much later when they realise, oh, those guys were the Beatles that they've... Also the fact that they've taken them out of the autograph book. But you can see you've got Paul Ramon, Carl Harrison, Johnny Lennon, Love Stewart, Johnny Gentle, and God bless him before he was whisked off in an ambulance, Tommy Moore.
There's probably DNA on that.
And put drums, just in case anybody wasn't sure. So these are the first set of autographs that we have. And like everything related to the Beatles, you know, eventually they end up at Christie's or Sotheby's.
Yep.
And in 2004, these autographs, described as a very rare early set of autographs, 23rd May 1960, on five pages, and inscribed during the Beatles' first ever tour, and they come up for sale in 2004, and they sell for anybody want to take a guess?
What would you pay for a set of the first Beatles autographs? $5,000, which seems kind of small, really.
We could have a whip round tonight, don't we think? Now, the interesting thing is there is another.
Yes, who is this person in the corner?
Can you read that? It says, "With best wishes, Margie." So, Margie was Johnny Gentle's girlfriend who had joined the tour. She was a glamour model, I think was the term.
Okay.
And she has the impossibly fabulous real name, Marjorie Overall. So
that is her real name.
And they had to pass her off as Mrs. Gentle because in those days, obviously, you know, hotels.
Yeah. And it would be another 9 years before John Lennon had another car crash in Scotland, going off the road, driving with Yoko and Kyoko and Julian crashing
in July 69. And he actually said, because he had the, you know, speaking from double experience, if you're going to have a car crash, try to arrange for it to happen in the Highlands. The hospitals are just great.
Now, the car crash gets reported in the newspaper. And this is significant because if we zoom in, Quincy style,
you're showing your age there, I think.
We get the first ever mention of Beatles in newsprint. So rock and roll singer Johnny Gentle and his group The Beatles, spelt in a way that would probably really annoy Stuart.
Yeah.
He's furious.
Two, three E's.
Escaped unhurt after a Dormobile in which they were travelling collided with a car at the junction of Seafield Street and Bondi Street. I'm sure there's a plaque there. This is kind of significant.
This is significant. So again, they've only just changed their name. So there's been nothing in the press in Liverpool. So this is the Banffshire Journal. Yeah.
And they do have to play the Fraserburgh gig, which means that when they turn up without a drummer, they have to go and pull Tommy Moore out of hospital with his bloody missing teeth and stick him behind the drum kit.
Yeah.
And John Lennon thinks this is hilarious and just laughs at him all night long.
The description is that, you know, the promoter says you can't do this gig without the drummer. He's doped to the eyeballs. He has missing teeth, no doubt bruising. And between after every song, Lennon is turning around and howling with laughter. I don't think Tommy Moore and John ever really bonded.
No, I don't think Tommy Moore was happy to be
there. No, he was definitely not happy.
They do have their second day off the following day.
They do.
And if you go to the Fraserburgh website, you can see these lovely dunes.
Yes. So if you're in Fraserburgh, you go to the dunes. So the context for this is at the gig the night before, there was a girl, a teenage girl, 17. She was just 17.
Hey.
Called Margaret Jacks. And she has a driving license, and she has been given the task by the local promoter of parking at the back of the venue so that whenever Johnny Gentle and Mrs. Gentle, Marjorie Overall, comes out, she can drive them to the hotel. But that doesn't happen. What happens instead is the Beatles come running down the back stairs, chased by teenage girls who are tearing at their shirts. They jump into the back of the car and shout, "Drive!" And she drives off. So this is sort of the first foreshadowing of that whole Beatlemania thing. So being like any sensible teenage girl, she drives them to her parents' house and introduces them to her parents. But she makes a date with Paul, as you would. Paul Ramone.
Paul, yes.
So the next day, she is driving Paul around Fraserburgh. I don't know how long that would take. Not long, I imagine. The rest of the band, who are no money, they're on the dunes. And two girls who were at the gig, Margaret Gold. I think all girls in Fraserburgh are called Margaret, I think, is the Margaret.
But Paul does recount this many years later.
He does. He says he remembers...
a wonderful afternoon playing in the sand dunes in Fraserburgh. That's from an interview in the mid-90s. So obviously left an impression.
With Margaret.
On him. Yes, having a role in the sand.
Yeah, but Margaret Gold, she will take pity on the other members of the band, and she makes them sandwiches and sews their shirts and things like that. So,
the tour rattles on. There's three more dates: 4th, 5th, and 6th on the 25th, 26th, 27th in Keith, Forez, and Nairn, all across that North Coast area. We have some pictures. There is a plaque.
This is the Regal Ballroom in Nairn.
Isn't that lovely? Regal. Absolutely nice. That's the plaque that they have in Keith, and that's the venue in Forez as well. So at this point, they're just kind of jobbing at this point. There's no novelty. It's just
this has become a relentless grind. They have had to do a runner from their hotel in Fraserburgh because they don't have the money to pay. You know, some nights they're sleeping in the back of the van. Because they didn't realise that they wouldn't get paid until the end of the tour. So they have no money. They have no change of clothes. They have no money. And supposedly, it's at this point, which is very near the end of the tour, and they're completely broke. Johnny Gentle is on the phone to Larry Parnes and John Lennon, grabs the phone off him and says, "We're fucking skint up here. We haven't got a pot to piss in. We need money, Larry." And Alan Williams sends him a fiver.
To keep them going.
Keep them going.
The other story that happens on this tour is there's apparently a John Lennon, Johnny Gentle co-written song.
Yes.
A song called "I've Just Fallen for Someone," which supposedly John kind of helps out with.
This is right at the beginning of the tour. So Johnny Gentle is a songwriter, and I think he's had three singles, and three of the six songs he writes or co-writes. So he's got this song. It's pretty much finished. John Lennon tells him he doesn't like the middle eight, and I think Johnny Gentle takes this a bit thick. You know, he's a songwriter. Who is this guy to tell him? But Lennon comes up with a middle eight.
Yeah, "We know that we'll get by, just wait and see, just like the song tells us, the best things in life are free."
So this is "the best things in life are free" is clearly a reference to, sorry, a theft from Barrett Strong's "Money," if you know that song from With the Beatles. Probably John's first plagiarism suit, narrowly
it
avoided.
It all happened in Scotland for the first time. Everything.
And interestingly, the other person who is here mentioning plagiarism, George is listening. So,
so it does get recorded by Adam Faith. You can see it's listed there under Askew, his real name. Johnny Gentle also tries to put it out himself. Shall we have a little listen, John?
If we must.
"We know that we'll get by, just wait and see, just like the song tells us, the best things in life are free. Like Humpty Dumpty,
I think that's
enough."
Enough of that. So this sets a precedent for co-written songs.
Anybody else write songs with?
I can't think of anybody who's ever written a song with the Beatles or would claim to have written a song with the Beatles. So
doesn't like to talk
about
it.
Nothing rings a bell.
No.
The show finishes with a seventh show in Peterhead in Scotland.
Yeah.
By this point they're totally wound down. They're tired.
Yeah,
they're basically going back to Liverpool the next day.
Yeah, they're going back to Liverpool the next day. This is their Vietnam. This has just been an absolutely horrendous experience for them. They're sleeping in the van. At one point, Paul recalls that they slept at a hay bale somewhere. Also, it's been an absolute baptism of fire for Stuart Sutcliffe, who... You know, the really tight group here is John, Paul, and George. And despite the fact that Stuart is John's close friend and has been persuaded to join the band, he is the butt of everybody's jokes. There are fist fights. George Harrison will talk about, fist fights with Stuart. They make him sit in the back of the van. The story is that they turn up at one of the B&Bs and they discover that the last people to stay there has been a circus troupe. One of the circus troupe is a dwarf, and they find out which bed the dwarf is in, and they make Stuart sleep in the dwarf bed, because nobody else will sleep there. So, I mean, it's been a real baptism of fire for Stuart, and worse for Tommy Moore, I think.
Well, yeah, they go back to Liverpool the next day, and we should probably talk about the coda of Tommy Moore. Here's one of the world's most depressing pictures, I think, of Tommy Moore after the fact.
Yeah.
This is a few years later.
I like the fact that you can see the photographer said, if you could just stand beside that piece of litter in the gutter.
Yeah, just
that
stand
would
beside
be...
all the other thrown away bits and pieces. Tommy Moore doesn't last long with the Beatles. He kind of hates them. He's older than them. He doesn't need that. And he kind of quits.
He basically says he's had enough of John Lennon. So he said, "I went to work for the Beatles. I joined the group. Tough living in the beginning, we did an invitation for a tour in Scotland. I needed something more secure, so I abandoned the hobby of playing the drums." And he does gig with them for a while when they get back to Liverpool. And then one day he just doesn't turn up for a gig. And they have to sort of go from the venue. They go round to the house, and his lovely wife, Vera, sells him to, checks notes, piss off. And that Tommy has gone back to work at the Bottle Works because it's a better...
And all this happens in a month. It's the 11th of June he quits. He only joined them on the 10th of May.
And this is the sort of the start of the revolving drummer stool. They get a Norman Chapman comes in for a while, then he gets sent off to do national service. So they're back to where they were before they did this audition.
And what happened to gentle old Johnny Gentle?
Johnny Gentle, there is a sort of a reunion with Johnny Gentle. So on the 2nd of July, the Silver Beatles, as they're now called, are playing the Grosvenor Ballroom in Liscard in Liverpool. Johnny Gentle is visiting Liverpool, finds out they're there, and just turns up at the venue. And by all accounts, very keen. They're very pleased to see him. And he gets up on stage and they do the entire set that they would have done in Scotland.
Yep.
And then he goes on to great things.
He goes on to turning up at Beatles.
Things. He does things. He goes on to things.
Things. Well, he is still alive. He will be 87 next month, Johnny Gentle. And
that's an achievement.
but he doesn't basically climb the heights of showbiz that some of the other Larry Parr.
No, this is his last hurrah.
And he did write a book in 1998 called Johnny Gentle and the Beatles, the First Ever Tour.
Yeah.
Have you read it?
No.
Okay. So what have we learned from all of this? Basically, they play 9 dates.
Yeah.
Or they play 7 dates in 9 nights.
Yeah.
And this is more shows than they had played in the previous, like, 6 months or something.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's you've got to think about where they actually were. They were just 4 mates and Tommy Moore pretending to be a band, essentially. This is not a serious endeavour for them. And then suddenly, most bands, you know, build up an audience and a repertoire and experience in their hometown, and then they perhaps go off on tour, they play the next town over. The Beatles have done none of that, and they're sent out on tour. So they just from a standing start, they're off on tour.
And Mark,
no other Liverpool band had done this
until
Cast and the Casanovas and then the Beatles.
And Mark Lewisohn is pretty adamant that this is the changing point.
Yeah, so Mark says, Mark. Mark says, the tour happened the wrong way around for them. They went on the road and found out about one another before they had performed any local bookings. And Mark will say that evening of the 18th and 19th of May, when Alan Williams is asking them, you know, would you do this? You know, they're the fifth choice, that this is the big turning point. The rest of their lives will be completely different after that decision. Yeah, we'll do it.
And Paul said in the 90s, you know, it was an important period for solidifying the band and getting our relationship strong with each other. And I suppose it prepared us for what was to come. We loved it and it was an invaluable experience for us. We knew it was no breeze. You had to work hard and you had to sort out where the money was coming from. It taught us a lot of lessons, but the audiences were great. They were wild.
Yeah.
And it's a point of this is where the camaraderie begins.
This, I think, is the point that this experience, which was not a pleasant experience, but this establishes the camaraderie that really will carry them through the next decade of Beatlemania. So the press attention, you know, the screaming fans, the military dictatorships, the KKK, the strength of character and the bond that will carry them through all that is really forged across this 10-day period. And it sort of establishes this notion of the band against the world. And as long as it remains the band against the world, could go wrong.
It's their first shows, their first fans, their first screaming groups, their first accidents. All this stuff happens on this tour. For the band being the band against the world, I think that's probably a story for part two.
Story for part two.
But what do you think, everybody? Okay, we'll see you in part two.